This is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. If one element of getting the perfect photograph is being in the right place at the right time, how is it that my next guest has been at all the right places at all the right times? In his new book, Rock Scene, legendary photographer Bob Gruen gathers together some of his favorite photographs from 40 years in the front row of rock and roll, offering an all-access pass to some of rock's biggest acts, from his iconic and personal photos documenting his friendship with John Lennon to his shots of the Ramones taking the subway to a gig at CBGB. Rock Scene is a family photo album, warts and all. We are happy it brings photographer Bob Gruen to our studio today. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you got a tough act to follow, Bob, because we've been talking about chaperone-assisted protein folding, which is the new rock and roll.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so now we're going to have to kick it old school and talk about the actual rock and roll.
Oh, good.
This is an amazing book. It's really beautiful. It's kind of a pun title. It's Rock Scene, S-E-E-N, because it's actually your eye.
It's what I've seen in my life.
It's what you've seen in your life, and you have kind of seen it all. Before we get into all the amazing moments that you've captured, what was your introduction to photography? When did you first pick up a camera and first say, this is something I like to do?
Well, actually, my mother's hobby was photography, and she's the
developer. Where did you grow up?
Pictures on Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were lawyers, but my mom, she had been developing and printing her pictures as a teenager herself, actually. Mm-hmm. And when I was too little to leave running around the house all by myself, she brought me in the darkroom, like around the age of 3, and taught me how to develop and print, showed me what she was doing. And I took a liking to it, and by the time I was 8, they gave me my first camera.
What was your first camera?
A Brownie Hawkeye.
Oh,
Kodak Brownie Hawkeye.
Of course.
And I started taking family photos and became the family photographer. And I think that was good training, because to me, a lot of rock bands are like families where you got 5 dysfunctional people and you have to make them all look good at the same time.
That's a really good point. People who have to kind of live together to survive, but they don't really like each other
very much. Yeah, you just got to get that moment where they all look like they enjoy being with each other. And,
their bar mitzvah.
Have a common thread.
So were you, as a little kid, were you also developing your own pictures too?
Yeah. And actually, my first picture was published when I was about 12, 13.
What was that?
It was a picture of a fire. I was taking pictures of exciting things.
Mm-hmm.
And I managed to get up behind the building that was burning. And that's another thing, is always like unusual angles that kind of show the whole scene of what's going on. So it all made sense later, and I did some politicians, I did the local football games and the school dances and things like that.
So what was your first sort of musical initiation? What was the music you were into when you were, 10, 12?
Well, I was growing up when rock and roll was invented. I mean, I remember seeing Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show, and, hearing things on the radio, Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. And I remember actually seeing Chuck Berry on a flatbed truck my first day when I went out to Illinois to a college. So I kind of came along with rock and roll.
And did you, it's weird. My parents are also professionals. My dad's a lawyer. And the idea of going into showbiz was sort of anathema to them, because there was nobody in the family had ever done anything like that. And it's scary to parents. Were your parents terrified that you were...
Well, not terrified. They just didn't see photography as a job. They saw it as a hobby, something to do after work.
Right.
But work was someplace you put on a shirt and tie and you went to the office.
Well, that's the thing with lawyers. They always say it can be your hobby. It's like, and then do something that you hate the rest of your life.
Exactly. And I didn't really see it that way. And, they kept trying to get me into the 9-to-5 job, but I just couldn't do the 9 o'clock part.
So you're ready for the rock and roll lifestyle.
So I ended up working with musicians, and we didn't usually start until noon. I mean, that's one of the nice things about an artist. You can sleep till noon. And that just suited me a lot better. Although it took a while to actually make a living. And I think I was probably around 45 when my first Genesis book came out, a really beautiful limited edition book about John Lennon. And my mom's friends were so impressed that she finally thought that I had done something. Since then, she's learned, because I've had some amazing exhibits. And in fact, I had a huge exhibit down in Brazil, and my mom came down and saw that. And so that I was really being respected for what I do. And now I've kind of gone from the black sheep to the white sheep of the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's
which is
good.
Fun, because you can't be the prodigal son unless you really screw up and then come back successful. So I've done it all,
Well, so before, you said it took a long time before you're really making a living at it. What were you initially doing, what were your first gigs as a photographer?
Oh, when I was a teenager, I baked waffles at the World's Fair. I was Santa Claus in a department store. Photography-wise, I actually worked in some studios, made the photographs for the museums where they would sell the slides at the museums, and very technical work. I took baby pictures early on. I wasn't very good at that. But I lived with a rock and roll band in the late 60s, first called the Justice League and then later called the Glitter House. And they were discovered by...
Who are they?
The Glitter House. They were discovered by Bob Crewe, who used them to sing the vocals for the Barbarella movie, is their cult claim to fame. And they put out an album self-titled Glitter House. And actually, they ended up going in different directions, but I stayed in the music business. I met the Atlantic Records publicist when they had their record, and he hired me to do Tommy James and the Shondells opening up for Hubert Humphrey.
Crimson and Clover.
In a parking lot in New Jersey. I mean, in Yonkers, I think. That was my first paid music business gig.
Tommy James and the Shondells.
Yeah, yeah. I went on from there. I think I did a Bee Gees party, and I met a lot of people. And then I met Ike and Tina Turner. Was the big break I had. I did a really excellent picture of Tina Turner one night because some friends of mine told me that Tina was great and we should come to see him. And I brought along my camera, and I took an amazing picture. It's multiple images in one exposure. Like there's a 1 second exposure while the strobe light flashed, and I caught these five images of Tina in one shot, and it's really, really excellent. And I brought the pictures with me a few nights later when we went to another Ike and Tina show, just to show my friends. And as we were leaving the show, Ike Turner came walking by because the dressing rooms were trailers outside the venue. And Ike Turner was walking behind me, and my friend saw it and pushed me in front of Ike and said, "Show Ike the pictures." And he stopped and said, "What pictures?" And I showed him, and he liked them. And he said, "Tina's got to see these." And he took me in the dressing room, and all of a sudden I'm standing there talking to Tina Turner, and she's liking my pictures. And, and so Ike introduced me to his publicist in New York, and I ended up traveling for a couple of years with Ike and Tina on the road, and I made videotapes with them. And that was really the beginning of my professional career, because I started meeting a lot of people through them.
Now, that's a pretty... how can I put this? An explosive place to be, you know, traveling with Ike and
I
Tina.
I learned a lot.
You
from
learned
Mike
a
Turner.
Lot. What did I?
Especially about getting cash up front. Ike was a really wonderful guy who helped a lot of people. He got a really bad rap in the movie. Mm-hmm. I think the movie about domestic violence was a very important movie and one to be made, but I don't think he was really the poster boy for that. There was a lot of other people, you know, in similar circumstances. I think in Ike's case, the movie should have been about what happens to a nice guy who takes too much cocaine. You know, because your personality changes a lot, and that's what happened to him. But he really helped quite a few people in his lifetime. He was a very giving person.
Well, it's interesting to hear a more nuanced point of view, because Ike Turner has become such a punchline, you know, over the years because of that movie.
And right. Well, like I say, it's a very important story that needed to be told. But I don't think he really should have been the poster boy.
So what did you learn something when you were traveling with Ike and Tina? Did you learn something about shooting musicians, shooting rock musicians? That's different from, you know, taking a picture of, say, a politician or you know, of a fire or the other things that you've been taking pictures of.
I don't know if it's different from a politician. It's different from a fire, but it's all about timing and, you know, respecting the privacy and the space of the person, not always intruding. You have to know when to put the camera down as well as when to take it up. You know, and the more you learn that, the more you get to share private moments with people.
Because you're more a part of the family.
You build up a trust. You know, if somebody knows that you're not going to embarrass them and you're not going to try to expose them, they begin to trust you, and you get more intimate pictures. You know, like being on the subway with the Ramones, you know, a casual moment like that, which doesn't happen if you just, you know, come in as a stranger and make an appointment for a certain hour, and that's your only hour. People tend to be nervous, and that makes the subject nervous. But when you're comfortable with the subject, they're comfortable with you, you get a much better feeling, because it takes a lot more time.
Right.
You know,
right.
I had to spend weeks on the bus with the Clash or the Sex Pistols, people like that. But that was fun. I enjoyed those things.
You know? I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate here on WNYC and WNYC.org, and I'm talking to the legendary rock photographer Bob Gruen about his new book, Rock Scene. So you you started with Ike and Tina, and I think, you know, some of the other people that you've photographed who, you know, that you've created these images that we're all so familiar with, your pictures of John and Yoko. How did your relationship with them start? And Well, when did that happen?
Similar to other relationships I developed, I met them through an interview in 1972, and I took some pictures of them that they liked my pictures, and they asked me to come back more often, and we started getting to know each other. They actually lived right around the corner from me, half a block away on Bank Street in Greenwich Village. And I don't know, we shared a similar cynical sense of humor, and they liked my photos, and I liked hanging out with them. John was very funny. He was really fun to be with. As comfortable as we got, I always knew that I was in a kind of a rarefied air, that he was John Lennon, and, you know, that was pretty special. But it really just developed as any friendship would. You just get to know each other more and more. And I used to wear that New York City T-shirt. I had a half a dozen of them. I would wear them all the time. And there was just guys in Times Square who sold them on the sidewalk. It wasn't even in a store. I think they made them themselves. But I really liked the graphics, the simplicity of it, and the power of New York City. You know, that people just are impressed with New York. And sometimes when I saw the guys, I would buy a couple extras and give them to my friends, and I gave one to John Lennon. And a year later, when we were on the rooftop shooting photos for his album cover, for the Walls and Bridges album, I remembered that I had given him the shirt, and I said, "Do you still have that shirt I gave you?" And he said, "Yeah," and he knew right where it was, which I was impressed, because he had been to L.A. and back, and we all know about that last weekend. You know,
that's right. That's
but he still knew where the shirt was, and he had it with him, and he put it on. And I mean, a lot of people think I took my shirt off and gave it to him, but I'd actually given it to him as a gift a year earlier. But it really looked good with the skyline around him. And then when he passed away, they asked me for a picture for the memorial in Central Park. And I picked that one because I felt that John really enjoyed living in New York, and he was a New Yorker. And he didn't die here because of any problem in the city. Yoko had mentioned that the person that killed him came from far away and would have come to wherever they lived. And that made me realize that John died in New York because he lived in New York. He died going home.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that New York City picture would be an important statement about that.
Well, that picture is so iconic. Was that the first time it was published after he died?
It was actually published in an interview that John did for Interview Magazine. He interviewed himself, which was a very funny interview.
How'd he come off in the interview?
He's a very funny guy. I mean, he's hilarious. He had nicknames for all his friends. He mentions me as Bob. Is it in focus, Gruen? But actually what I think is a more important picture is the picture that I took of John at the Statue of Liberty, which was when the government was trying to throw him out. Richard Nixon was afraid. John Lennon was talking about peace in a time of war, and they felt that that was not a good thing. So they tried to throw him out of the country, and I felt that the Statue of Liberty is welcoming people to America. It was a good symbol of welcoming. A great artist like John Lennon should be welcome in America. And so I went out with him. I suggested it to him, and he liked the idea, which I was absolutely thrilled that I came up with something that John Lennon liked, you know. And we went out and spent the afternoon, took some pictures out there, and it wasn't as popular at the time. I think people were afraid to publish it because of the political aspects of his case.
Mm-hmm.
But after he passed away, it became a much more important picture that I think people relate to John Lennon in terms of personal freedom, similar to the way they relate to the Statue of Liberty.
Mm-hmm. You know, these two images in particular become so iconic. And I guess another way of saying iconic is much copied without permission everywhere.
it does get bootlegged pretty often.
I'm just wondering how do you feel about that? You know, we're in an age now, sort of so-called free content, where everybody
well, people
thinks
think on the web what you see is what you get.
Yeah,
you
they
know,
think that that people have the right. People sort of don't. The whole notion of paying an artist for what they've done seems very. It seems like being a silversmith or something.
Yeah,
it's
people
a very
hear a lot about the musicians who don't get paid, but photographers don't get paid either.
That's right. You don't get paid even worse than musicians.
Yeah, people because the musicians take the pictures too.
That's right. how
and
do
they
you
use them? But
how do you feel about that? I mean,
I'd like to get paid for my work.
Yes.
I've always wanted to be paid for my work.
Yes.
But I've always been paid very little. I'm a low-budget kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I try to take it as a compliment instead of being angry. I could spend all my time being negative and trying to track down every single person that stole something. But those bootleggers and the people that steal things can steal anything. And the fact that they consistently choose my pictures, I take as a compliment.
Well, so you've reached a higher level of Zen enlightenment than a lot of people have. I mean, that's actually probably a very...
I try to stay calm and see the positive side of life.
You seem extremely calm. For a guy who's lived as much rock and roll as you have, you seem extremely calm. So you really were part of the kind of some of the most seminal acts in America, like, you know, John Lennon, the Turners. But then you had the vision, I guess, to see that something really big was coming down the pike, which was punk, which back
well, one thing leads to another in my life. It's very funny to me that actually meeting John Lennon, I met his backup band, The Elephant's Memory. They were managed by the same people that managed Aerosmith and the New York Dolls, which was how I got to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, you know, it's funny in my life that I met John Lennon led me to the New York Dolls, because I don't think John actually ever saw the Dolls. We tried a couple of weekends, but it was the wrong timing. And meeting the Dolls, as they were breaking up, Malcolm McLaren came to sell them some clothes, and he managed them for a couple of weeks. And then a year and a half later, when I went to England, Malcolm's was the only phone number I had, and Malcolm McLaren was managing the Sex Pistols and took me to this Club Louise, where I met the Sex Pistols, the Clash, Susie and the Banshees, Billy Idol. Again, like you said in your introduction, I seem to be at the right place at the right time.
Well, and the Ramones, of course.
And well, that was thanks to Lisa Robinson with Rock Scene magazine. Mm-hmm. Danny Fields discovered the Ramones, and he was part of the Rock Scene crew. And we had a magazine called Rock Scene, spelled the normal way, as if the Rock Scene, and we covered the whole scene. So it wasn't just a photo of a guy with Mike on stage, but we did At Home, and, you know, I had pictures of the Ramones hanging out in Forest Hills and then taking the train to the gig and then posing out in front of the gig and then in the dressing room and then actually on the stage. So we would do whole stories, and I think that gave me more access to the rock and roll lifestyle rather than just an assignment to get a picture of a guy on a stage.
Well, you wouldn't think of the Ramones as being maybe the most photogenic people in the world, but
had a look.
They had a look.
and
you managed to capture. Well, I want to talk more about the Ramones and the punk scene after the news. I'm speaking with photographer Bob Gruen about his 40-year career capturing musicians and the music business on film. His amazing new book, you have to check it out. It's called Rock Scene. It's published by Abrams. And you can see a slideshow, always a slideshow, of photographs by Bob Gruen by going to our show page at WNYC.org. And we'll have more with Bob Gruen after the news.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, or WNYC and WNYC.org. And I've been speaking to the legendary photographer, Bob Gruen, who has a new book out from Abrams. It's called Rock Scene, with an introduction by Debbie Harry. That's pretty cool.
Oh, Debbie's very cool.
Yeah, she sure is. We'll talk about her in a minute. Get back to talking about the punk acts that you photographed. You know, so many people, when punk first came out in the mid to late 70s, they were like, you know, this isn't music, that they can't play the instruments and whatever. Did you know that there was something going on with these guys?
It was exciting, and it was rock and roll. I mean, it was very exciting. But like I say, in my life, it's a progression from one to the other. And I was hanging out with the Elephant's Memory, led me to the New York Dolls, which led me to the whole scene down at CBGB's with the Ramones and Blondie and Talking Heads and Patti Smith. And so I went to England. The only phone number I had was Malcolm McLaren, and he brought me to Club Louise, and I met the Sex Pistols and the Clash, and I saw the Clash play that trip in 76, and they were just the most amazing, powerful band I'd ever seen. So I really I liked them a lot. When I came back a year later, I called the record company, and they said, oh, they don't talk to us, you know, they're punks, and, you know, they think we're corporate, and they won't have any contact with the record company. I said, well, I'm a fan, and I'll buy a ticket on the sidewalk to see them if I have to, because I really want to see them. And I think that's one thing that really led to me getting better pictures, because I am a fan,
mm-hmm.
and I will do things like that. And it's not just an assignment to, you know, make a certain amount of money or something, but I like to see bands, mm-hmm. and I enjoy the rock and roll music. And I think that one reason the rock scene in my book has so many more photos than anybody else's book is because I'm a fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I went to a show at Madison Square Garden afterwards, I would go to Max's, I would go to CB's, I would go to Ashley's afterwards, I would go to rock and roll places, and I wouldn't, you know, other people went home after
right.
the first gig. I went out to three more gigs because I enjoyed it.
Would that earn you more cred with the bands? Could they sense the difference between, say,
Well, I wasn't there just as a journalist at 3 o'clock in the afternoon with an appointment with their publicist.
Right.
I was there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I would give them a ride home because I always had a car. Being part of the scene gave me more cred. And I think that when I went to England, being introduced by Malcolm, McLaren, who's somebody that had been to New York and knew about the scene, and the fact that I'd worked with the New York Dolls, and Rock Scene magazine had a lot of credit over there because it made fun of the scene. Rock Scene magazine was not taken seriously like a major magazine in this sense. It was much more fun. We actually wrote the magazine like a 12-year-old girl's scrapbook and diary. We didn't just have stories about bands that were signed to record labels or had advertising. In fact, we had very little advertising, which made for a lot more pages of stories.
Right.
But we could do what we wanted because we weren't being dictated to by the record companies. So we ran photos of a lot of new bands, a lot of interesting bands, and the kids in England knew that, and they liked that. And the fact that I came from that kind of background, that I obviously was a fan and I wasn't out to expose them, it helped a lot.
Did you have a favorite Sex Pistol? Was there one pistol who rose above
the
rest? Oh, like
John Paul, George, or Ringo? I don't know. They're all actually pretty nice guys. I mean, Johnny Rotten is pretty rotten. When I met him, I thought he was the most obnoxious person I ever met.
But funny.
And he works on it, but he is funny. Mm-hmm. And he was never mean to me. Mm-hmm. And Sid, I got to talk to quite a bit on the bus when he was actually sober. They kept him off the heroin for at least a few days. And we were talking about Nancy, who I had known before Sid met her. I knew Nancy from New York.
Because she was following a lot of bands.
And she was a friend of the Heartbreakers, and she was around CBGBs a lot. And she was kind of that prostitute with a heart of gold, you know. Deep inside, she was a pretty good person. And I knew that about her, and Sid knew that. Although she could have a really obnoxious side, a whiny side to her. But I think that, you know, spending time with them, it really does help to get to know people a lot. It wasn't just an assignment. It was my lifestyle. I lived it. You know, I didn't just visit as a journalist.
Now, somebody had the great idea with the Sex Pistols after they made it really big in England in 77 or so. They said, mm-hmm. Let's break them in America by having them tour the Deep South, because they'll go down really well.
Well, that was Malcolm's idea. It was not to play the typical press places. Like, if you play to the press is pretty jaded, and they just show up and yawn. But if you don't let them in, then they want to know what's going on.
Right.
And Malcolm didn't want them to play at the regular CBGB place for the typical New York audience, but have them play at places where they create controversy. And they certainly did that in the South. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before. He tried to do that with the New York Dolls. At the end of the Dolls' career, Malcolm actually had put together something of a tour starting in Florida, but the band broke up before they ever left Florida.
What was the response? I guess the thought was in the Deep South there was unemployment and anger and things like that, and people would respond. They'd be on the same page as these British guys.
Well, some people were. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really had a very mixed response. I mean,
now, that's interesting because that's not the way it's always been reported one way, which was, you know, oh, people just didn't know what to make of them. But you're saying they did find.
Some people really didn't like them and were throwing beer bottles. But it seemed to be the style, because in a couple of the clubs they actually had a netting in front of the stage. These people apparently throw beer bottles at anybody.
It was the etiquette. Like. It was the
prevailing
etiquette.
That's what you do. You know, bands on stage, just throw some beer bottles. You know, that's how we party. But I remember in Texas, some guy coming backstage and pulling his shirt back and showing the Sex Pistols that he had a gun. And saying, you know, there's some people out there, you know, there might be some trouble, but don't worry because we got your back and we're going to take care of you. And these English kids who had never seen a gun, the police in England don't carry guns. And all of a sudden here was this guy in the dressing room, but he was promising that he was their friend and he was on their side, so it seemed like it was okay. But yeah, that was kind of a shocking moment. But they did create the kind of controversy that Malcolm was looking for. Mm-hmm. And it made them national news. I remember one night in Texas, somebody had yelled something or thrown something at Sid, and Sid hit the kid with it or tapped him with his guitar. And later in the hotel room, when I was back at the hotel, somebody on the phone said that, you know, I saw on TV tonight in the New York News that Sid hit somebody with his guitar. And the kid didn't get hurt. It was not a big incident. It went by in a second. And I was just amazed that this was national news, that some kid from an English rock band bump somebody with his guitar, and that's national news. Whatever works. So they were very controversial, and Malcolm proved his point. And by the end of the tour, the record company was so interested in Johnny Rotten, but not the band, that they basically broke up the band.
Right, and then he went on.
I remember coming home, and I spent the first 2 days developing all the pictures. I'd been on the road for 10 days with them by accident, by the way. I went to Atlanta to see the first show, planning to come home that night. And I said, as they were getting on the bus, I said, well, have a great time. I'm sure you're going to have a wonderful tour. Too bad I can't come. And Malcolm started saying, well, you can't come because we can only have 12, and there's this one and that one, and the band and the guards. And, well, that's only 11, Bob. Get on the bus. And I was like, what? And the guy next to me said, I'll come, Malcolm. And he goes, nope, Bob asked first. And I was like, when was that? You know. But I got on the bus. I woke up in San Francisco 10 days later, and I said, what am I doing here? And I came home. I developed all the pictures for 2 days and then walked through a snowstorm over to CBGB's to take a break and relax. And Johnny Rotten was there, and he was wearing this T-shirt that Warner Brothers had given us all T-shirts that said, I survived the Sex Pistols tour. And on Johnny's, he had added, but the band didn't. And he said, you hear the news, mate? And he showed me the shirt. And I said, what does that mean? He goes, we broke up, man. I was like, but you're the biggest band in the world. Everybody's interested in you. He goes, nope, we broke up.
Well, that's
that
rock
was very
and roll.
Punk.
Yeah, very punk. Yeah. I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm talking to Bob Gruen about his great new book, Rock Scene, and his career as a rock photographer. We're here at WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, I mentioned before you have this introduction in your book by Debbie Harry, Blondie, and that's a cool thing. How did you guys get to know each other? I mean, she was part of that whole CBGB's.
Well, I met Debbie actually shortly before the Blondie. They had a band called, I'm going blank on the name.
The fact that you're forgetting something is completely Debbie Harry.
Stilettos.
Stilettos.
And they had songs like Platinum Blonde and Puerto Rico and stuff. And with Elder Gentile, they had a band. Elder worked at Max's and Debbie worked at Max's, and they kind of got this band together, three girls in front. And I think Chris Stein was in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Fred Sonic Smith, who later married Patti Smith, was in that band. And then they kind of morphed into the Blondie band. So I'd already met her, but I do remember clearly the first time was Lisa Robinson called me up and said, you have to go and photograph this girl. There's a girl in the band called Debbie Harry, and she's absolutely beautiful, and she's going to be big.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down, and the first time I saw her, I knew that Lisa was right. I mean, Debbie's, I think, you know, the Marilyn Monroe, the sex goddess image of our generation.
And you have I actually want to talk about a few of the pictures you've got in the book, which is just, it's an incredible document of rock. You have this great photo of her in front of the cyclone at Coney Island.
Oh, Coney Island! Yeah, that looks great.
Yeah, how was that? How did that come about? Was that your idea?
Actually, Punk Magazine was doing a photo novella, which is a comic mm-hmm. book made of photographs.
Sure.
And they had all the punks out at Coney Island one afternoon. I think aliens come out of the ocean and start eating people. and Debbie and Joey Ramone and a whole bunch of this, the whole gang was out there. And it was like a rare moment when we were all awake in the daytime and functioning, and people were trying to, I recognize you, but who are you? You know, like, and Debbie's just always been gorgeous, and she just was really hot that day, and she just came walking across the street, and I took the picture. And actually, for many years, it was in the files, and there was another picture much closer up that we had been using, and one day there was an auction, and I wanted to make a print of that picture, and we couldn't find it. We went back to look in the file, and I found the other one, the one, the Coney Island one there. And it just looked great. And I made the print. And then a French editor happened to be in my house. And he flipped out over it. And he printed a double page. And people have been liking it ever since. So it's become one of the more popular pictures I have.
You also have a great picture in here of Bob Marley at the Beacon. Was Bob Marley somebody you took a lot of pictures of?
I saw him play a couple of times. I saw him do a press conference that was totally amazing, even though half of it was in Rastafari, but it was just spiritually out there, and he was a very powerful force, but one that made people really feel good and want to dance.
Mm-hmm.
And he was terrific.
But you didn't have the same intimate relationship with him.
No.
What about the Stones? You have a great picture of them on stage. I know this, the radio is a perfect medium to discuss great photographs.
Right. You have to buy the book.
But you just have to picture. There's a great photograph of the Rolling Stones at Madison Square Garden. Was that 72?
72. I took a bunch of great shots. They had some really good lighting, and I got some really good sharp photos for once. I've always liked the Stones. I saw them, like most things in my life, by accident in 1965. I ran into somebody who had some tickets for the Stones at the Academy of Music, and I had never even heard of the Rolling Stones.
Really?
And she said, you want some tickets for the Stones? And I'm like, what's that? She goes, it's a band from England. And I was like, a band is playing in a theater? I thought bands played in bars, you know? Like, I didn't know they played in a theater. And I went in, and it was like more exciting than my first acid trip. It was totally amazing.
That is saying something.
Yeah, it was.
Mr. Bob
Gruen. It was just really flipped out. People screaming and yelling, and the music so loud, and I couldn't make sense of anything except the bass line for Satisfaction at the end went on for like 15 minutes, and then it lasted in my mind, was the only thing I could hear for the next month. I was totally hooked.
Well, I've been speaking with photographer Bob Gruen about his 40-year career capturing musicians and the music business on film. And his book is called Rock Scene. It's published by Abrams. He'll be in conversation with musician, writer, and producer Lenny Kaye
Monday night
at 7. Oh, at the great, great 92nd Street Y Tribeca. It's a very cool venue. For more information, visit our show page, where you can also see a slideshow of photographs by Bob. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm doing a signing at the ICP, actually, tomorrow. And next Friday, I'm doing a signing at the Marc Jacobs store.
Excellent. Excellent. We'll put those on the show page as well.
Great.
Take it easy.
Okay.
Bye-bye.